I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, House impeachment managers laid out their case accusing former President Trump of inciting the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, using his own words against him through video, tweets, and audio clips. They also presented never-before-seen surveillance video from inside the Capitol building showing just how close the mob was to where the senators and representatives and their staff were hiding. And they showed terrifying body camera footage from the police fighting off the insurgents, many of them armed, threatening to kill Vice President Pence and House Speaker Pelosi. So did the House managers persuade enough Republicans to find Trump guilty in this impeachment trial and prevent him from running for office ever again? That's a tall order, considering some of the response from some of the Republicans. We're going to play some clips from yesterday's trial, talk with our guests about some of the legal, constitutional, and political issues at stake in this trial and what to expect today. The trial will get underway in just a couple of hours. Let me introduce our two guests. Amanda Turkle joining us by Skype, and she's Washington Bureau Chief for Huffington Post. Amanda Turkle, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Elliot Williams, and he's a principal at the Rabin Group. That's a public affairs firm in Washington, D.C. He's a CNN legal analyst, previously was counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee. This was back in 2007-09 under Senator Chuck Schumer. Elliot Williams, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty. And as someone who grew up in New Jersey about an hour from where you are and went to Penn, I have a special place in my heart for WHYY, so this will be great.
That is so nice of you to say. We have a theory that everyone has a connection to Philadelphia or the Philadelphia area in one form or another. So happy have you both here. There is so much to talk about. And let me just begin with kind of a broad question. And perhaps, Elliot, I'll toss it first to you. The cumulative effect, and I have to say that I watched the whole thing yesterday because that's what I do. We're talking about 8 hours of testimony, of video, of very emotional appeals. What was the impact on you? And then I want to talk about what you think the impact was on members of the Senate. But for you, Elliot, what was it like to watch all that?
Yeah, you know, number one, it was clear watching it that it's amazing what a case can be built without a single witness's testimony. It's all on video. And never, as a prosecutor, which I was with the Justice Department before, never sort of in any proceeding I saw in Congress, frankly, in the, I guess, three impeachments I've now seen in my adult life, never have we been able to find such a compelling case that all exists on video. And frankly, the House managers don't need to even call a single witness. Like, if you read their briefs, the case against Donald Trump is made simply by what we saw yesterday. Now, in terms of what we saw yesterday, it was profoundly compelling. And what the House managers were quite successful at doing was not just humanizing the events of the day, but themselves as litigants, and themselves as litigants who are speaking to a body that they also belong to. It's a member of Congress reaching other members of Congress saying, look, you see these things on video. We were all attacked on that day, and you might be free to vote against this if you wish, but look at what this did to us, not just the American people. And I think that, which is very powerful to watch.
Sure, and I want to pick up on that. But Amanda, let me get you in on the conversation. Just curious about your takeaways as you watched yesterday's testimony.
Well, watching the videos has been it's been pretty tough. And I know that's been true for a lot of the journalists who were there that day. We had two reporters from HuffPost who were on the Hill that day. One was sitting in the House chamber for quite a while and was there when the pounding started. And, you know, he didn't know. Someone yelled out shots fired, and he wasn't sure if it was gunfire, if it was someone pounding and breaking glass. Another one of our reporters was the reporter who famously captured Eugene Goodman, the officer who was holding back the crowds, the mob coming in. And so, you know, for them, watching it, I think, has been pretty tough and pretty emotional. And, you know, the videos are designed to make the senators uncomfortable and to remind them of how wrenching it was for that day. And I think, you know, you really heard that from Congressman Jamie Raskin, the lead House impeachment manager, on the first day, talking about how his family was there, how the riot was just one day after he had buried his son. who had committed suicide. And so it was very, very hard for him. And, you know, a lot of some Republicans were moved, but so far the reaction that we've heard from Republicans is that they haven't changed their mind. They're still not planning to convict Donald Trump.
And I want to pick up on that as well. Let me go back to you, Elliot, and what we're talking about, because it was an attack on the U.S. government, on the Capitol, on the members of our Congress inside. So the senators, they're witnesses, they're victims, and they're also a member of the jury. Can they have an open mind?
I don't think they can, and that's one of the bizarre quirks of how our system's set up. They're witnesses, you know, I'm trying to remember the list you ran up. They're witnesses, they're members of the jury. They're also deciders of law. So they are, the day started, if you remember, Tuesday started with a vote on the constitutionality of whether it was appropriate to proceed with an impeachment proceeding in the first place. So that makes them fact finders, judges of law, witnesses, but also potentially co-conspirators. And, you know, I'm not going to wag fingers at any particular Republicans, but, you know, a number of senators were giving speeches on that day on the floor of the Senate in the form of, I believe, I can't recall what Senator Lankford's speech was. He was the one who was speaking when they were evacuated. Obviously, we know Senator Cruz, Senator Hawley, and so on, that were this a criminal trial or even a civil trial, you could probably have prosecuted them for conspiracy in the underlying act with the president.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Again, were it a criminal trial, and I want to be very careful and clear and say it is not, and the president is not held to that standard. He's not a criminal defendant at all. I'm simply making the point that in addition to witnesses, triers of law, triers of fact, suspects, co-conspirators, finders of law, there's this weird space that senators exist in this bizarre proceeding. And given the political climate we're in, it's almost certain that it would be impossible for any of them to be truly impartial as they approach the proceeding.
Amanda, let me go back to you. And then I do want to play actually a clip from Jamie Raskin talking about the First Amendment and the president. But, you know, I wish the camera, and I know it doesn't happen, but I wish the camera were on at times on members of the Senate just to see how were they watching, you know, were they watching, what were they doing? You know, there were reporters there who were telling us things, but I felt as a viewer, I would have wanted to have seen that for myself.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you. And our reporters who were there, who were in the gallery watching all this, said that, you know, there were a lot of Democrats, you know, taking notes, paying very close attention, you know, looking pretty sort of shocked and disturbed by some of what they were learning, which, you know, I will add some of the footage and some of the audio is new stuff that's never been seen before. They said a lot of Republicans were not paying very close attention. They seemed to be reading, you know, just doing other work, reading papers that weren't related to the trial. You know, there were some who were paying attention. You know, we saw Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican from Louisiana, say that he was very moved by the presentation on the first day, which is why he sort of voted to move forward on the constitutionality question. But, you know, again, most Republicans seem to have their mind made up, and they've said that they haven't seen anything new. They're not changing their minds.
We heard from Trump's lawyers that they will use a First Amendment argument, I guess, saying that, you know, political speech is protected and that what the president was doing was using political speech. But let me play a clip. And this is House Impeachment Manager. This is Representative Jamie Raskin. And he expands on this analogy of shouting fire in a crowded building as an argument for Trump's impeachment. Let's give it a listen. And then, Elliot, I'll put the ball in your court. This is about a minute.
This case is much worse than someone who falsely shouts fire in a crowded theater. It's more like a case where the town fire chief, who's paid to put out fires, sends a mob not to yell fire in a crowded theater, but to actually set the theater on fire. And who then, when the fire alarms go off and the calls start flooding into the fire department asking for help, does nothing but sit back, encourage the mob to continue its rampage and watch the fire spread on TV with glee and delight. So then we say this fire chief should never be allowed to hold this public job again, and you're fired and you're permanently disqualified, and he objects. And he says, we're violating his free speech rights just because he's pro-mob or pro-fire or whatever it might be. Come on. I mean, you really don't need to go to law school to figure out what's wrong with that argument.
And Elliot, going to you, what he also said is that, you know, regular people have the right to say all sorts of outrageous things and very incendiary things, but that the president's, you know, words have a different kind of effect. To help us understand what this argument is coming from the Democrats, which I think will be central because I do believe we're going to hear it from Trump's lawyers.
So let me make two different points in response. And Senator Raskin, as folks may or may not know, you know, he's a constitutional law professor for 20 or 30 years, has been teaching this material and distilled that point very perfectly. So one, on this question of the speech rights that regular people hold, that's a very powerful two-word phrase, regular people that use, because the president is not a regular person. No president is a regular person. I don't mean to say in the regal sense like we sort of we broke off from England, that we think of the president as special, but the president's the only person in the federal government who has the job that only one person can hold at a time. Like, even the Chief Justice has peers on the Supreme Court who can step in his place. Members of Congress can be. So the president just stands in a class by himself or herself, and his or her words do carry special different weight. Now, on the First Amendment point as to protected political speech, like Raskin says, that is just nonsense and is not true as a matter of law. And the House managers shot that down right away. And the best examples that the House managers used in their paper briefs, they haven't said this at the trial yet, were think of what that would mean if a president could say whatever he or she wanted. So a president could burn an American flag on the lawn of the White House, which is protected First Amendment conduct, but certainly not conduct that anyone would want the president of the United States engaged in. A president could put on a Klan hood and march in a Klan rally. Again, you can be a member of the Ku Klux Klan if you want. I wouldn't advise it, but under the First Amendment. And it's deplorable but protected conduct that were a president to engage in it ought to be impeachable. A president could wear swastikas and go to Jewish neighborhood. All of these horrible things that the First Amendment protects. So the idea that merely because we have a First Amendment that protects speech entitles a president to say and do whatever he wants, including when that means potentially inciting violence or inciting riots, is simply not true. So they're misstating the law. I see where they were trying to go with it or how they're trying to confuse the public. But you just can't, as a government official, particularly that solitary, unitary government official, expect to hide behind the law and get away with it, particularly now that people are dead and the Capitol's been desecrated.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break. We'll pick up on our conversation talking with Elliot Williams. He's a CNN legal analyst. Also with us, Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief for Huffington Post. We are talking about what happened yesterday, day two of the impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. And we want to hear from you. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us 1-888-477-9499. If you watched any or all of the trial yesterday, what were your impressions? What are the issues, ideas, things that you are wrestling with? We want to hear from you. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We're talking about how the House managers presented their arguments yesterday that former President Trump incited the riot and attack on the U.S. Capitol. We'll be talking a bit more about what Trump's legal team has to do, and they will be presenting their arguments tomorrow. Also, some of the political and constitutional issues at stake. And again, Elliot Williams with us, CNN legal analyst, and Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief for Huffington Post. And we've got comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Amanda, let me go back to you. And we do want to play a clip of Representative Castro discussing President Trump's attacks on the vice president. But the House managers made a lot, several of them talked very emotionally about the role that the vice president played, obviously, on that day when the Electoral College votes were counted, but also how he was targeted and also how he was not protected by the president. Set that up for us, and then we'll play the clip. Do we have Amanda?
Sure.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Sorry.
I wasn't. I thought the clip was coming.
So, okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
Sure. So, you know, we've heard from a lot of Democratic lawmakers that they felt like their lives were in danger and they were really sort of nervous. But I think a key point in, you know, what may garner more sympathy from Republicans, to be honest, is that, you know, Vice President, like you said, Vice President Mike Pence's life was in danger. We heard some rioters saying that they wanted to lynch Mike Pence, that if they got their hands on him, that they would kill him. And it was because Trump was saying that Mike Pence basically had the ability to overturn, basically to stop Joe Biden from becoming the winner, which is not true at all. You know, Mike Pence said he was not going to do that. He was going to do his constitutional duty and certify the election results. And Trump was furious. And so he kept sort of riling up his supporters about this. And that is why Mike Pence was in such danger and had to be whisked away.
Well, let me play that clip. And this is, again, Representative Joaquin Castro, and he's discussing President Trump's attacks on the vice president as Capitol stormers were chanting for his execution.
At 2:24 p.m., he tweeted, quote, "Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution. USA demands the truth." Over an hour and a half into the attack, and this is what he tweeted. And he still, even at this point, did not acknowledge the attack on the Capitol, let alone condemn it. Instead, he further incites the mob against his own vice president, whose life was being threatened.
Elliot, let me go back to you. And I just, you know, Joaquin and Castro talks about the truth. And I think we need to put the truth out here, which is that Joe Biden won the 2020 election. He got something like 7 million more votes. He got more electoral college votes. It's been certified. It's been taken to court multiple times, including here in Pennsylvania. And he is the legitimate president of the United States. I just want to put that out there.
Yeah. And look, the president's team filed, I believe it was 62 challenges to the legitimacy of the election. And as a candidate, he was entitled to challenge results that deemed to be inaccurate. But 62 of them failed. And the president leaned on the Secretary of State of Georgia in a personal call, called Michigan elections officials to reward them for not certifying results. And there was, and this is part of the case that the House managers make, that the president's misconduct did not just start on the morning of January 6th. That in fact, the first, I think July 19th, 2020, which is the first time president went on Fox News Sunday and stated that he couldn't commit to agreeing to the outcome of the election, depending on what it was. So it's 6 months of undermining the election, ending with all of those lawsuits and finally ending in tragedy on January 6th, hours after Mike Pence himself was threatened. Mm-hmm. And one more quick point about Mike Pence that's really powerful here. The House managers also quite effectively lay out, Amanda's been in the Capitol building. I have too. I don't know if you have, Marty. Not in years, but it's not that big. And they really do lay out just how close Mike Pence was to peril, that, you know, one right turn down a stairwell, another turn, and he's face to face with a mob. You saw that with video of Chuck Schumer. My God, the video of Mitt Romney running down the hall with Officer Goodman waving him down the hall. So, this all could have ended in horrific calamity for any of these members, particularly the vice president.
And Marty.
Yeah, go ahead, Amanda. Yep, go ahead.
Sure. And so one thing, too, that happened that was pretty consequential yesterday that didn't happen in the impeachment hearing, so not as many people know about it, is Senator Tommy Tuberville from Alabama, Republican, who's close to Trump. So Trump called him that day, and the senator said that he didn't get a chance to say much because he told him, "Mr. President, they just took the vice president out. I've got to go." Pence was removed from the Senate at 2:14. Trump then, so that phone call happened sometime after that. Trump then lashed out at Pence at 2:24 on Twitter, saying Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done. So in other words, Trump tweeted this anti-Pence tweet after he had learned that Pence's life was in danger. And so you've heard some of Trump's allies try to say that as soon as Trump found out about the siege, he was really upset and he wanted it to stop. And all the evidence we have shows that that's not true. He was, he was sort of excited and happy that his supporters were doing this. And this is another piece of evidence to show that he really didn't care that his own vice president's life was in danger. He continued to tweet about him even after he found out.
You know, it's interesting. The president, President Trump, was taken off Twitter. I'll put this to you, Elliot. But he hasn't been on Newsmax or OAN or Fox. I mean, he could say something. He could be interviewed. And yet we don't hear anything from our president, our former president.
And in fact, one of the arguments the president has made against the trial and his lawyers are making is that the president has not been entitled to due process, that the president isn't allowed, you know, this is all a sham and so on. You know, the trial managers, the House managers invited the president to testify and he chose not to. Now, any reasonable, rational lawyer would know that the president would likely not be a great witness you'd want to put on the stand. But needless to say, he's at every opportunity to do so. But my guess, I don't know, but my guess is that he's getting advice from individuals around him that he could only jeopardize his case by speaking out publicly. Again, we know this from 4 years of watching, 5 years, 6 years of watching the president's statements, and that's got to be what's behind it.
A quick follow-up to that, Elliot. I was reading that a grand jury, that the House impeachment is like a grand jury, and that what I'm realizing this is mm-hmm. political on Leo, but nonetheless, that the House is kind of like the grand jury, and the Senate is the trial. I mean, is that helpful to help us understand what's going on?
Yeah, so your listeners understand. You know, the grand jury brings charges, votes on charges. It's an arm of the prosecutor, and then they're filed on the court and then they're put before a jury and prosecutors try them. Right. It gets a little bit blurry as we were talking about right at the top of the show where, yes, the Senate is technically the trial jury, but they're also here witnesses and, victims and accomplices and so on. But that's the closest thing. This is the jury that the case is being tried to.
And that is Elliot Williams. He is a CNN legal analyst. Also with us, Amanda Turkle, Washington bureau chief for Huffington Post. We are talking about yesterday's impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. Day two. Day three begins in just a couple of hours, and NPR and WHYY carrying that trial live. Let me read a couple of comments here. Amanda, a Facebook comment from Joan says, I heard an analyst say that if it were a secret vote, there would more likely be a conviction. Is there a possibility of doing this? If not, why not? Do you think a secret vote would result in a different result?
I think it could. I still don't think there would be enough senators to get a conviction, but you might see a few more because obviously, you know, as we've talked about, as has been talked about quite a bit, these Republicans, they're afraid of Trump. Trump is out of office, but he, still wields quite a bit of political power, and his supporters are obviously willing to go to great lengths to do what he says. So if he wants to get angry and, fight them in the primaries and just make life miserable for them, he can do that. And so a lot of them are afraid to do that. So, yes, I think a secret ballot would change some people, but I don't know if it would be enough.
Hey, Marty.
Yeah, go ahead,
Elliot. Quick follow up on that.
Sure.
Just to piggyback on Amanda's point. In fact, and this is a Chuck Schumer issue. If, in fact, it doesn't look like they'll get close to the 17, as Amanda says, it seems like not. It's actually in the Democrats' interest to have it be a public vote, because then, sort of as Amanda was getting to, then you put them all on the record. And for those campaign ads in 2022 and 2024, you can remind people who are in the purplish states that are running for office that this is how the individual voted. But yeah, certainly some... people could feel, and Mitch McConnell is on the, was reported to have said that it's now a vote of conscience now that the constitutionality issue is passed.
And Amanda, go ahead.
Sure.
Lots to talk about.
Yeah. And another thing is what Elliot was saying, this, how Democrats are going to use this politically. I mean, a lot of the reason you're hearing Democrats talk about what happened to law enforcement. I mean, obviously, part of it is because law enforcement and their injuries and their fatalities were a big part of the day. But also, you know, Republicans have tried to place themselves as this law and order party, that they support, you know, law enforcement. And yet, you know, it's sort of like, how can these GOP senators hear what happened to these law enforcement officials who are trying to protect them and trying to protect the Capitol and democracy and still say that it doesn't matter enough and vote not to convict President Trump? And so that's why we've heard, you know, we heard this new audio yesterday of law enforcement saying, you know, multiple injuries, we need help very quickly. And we've seen, you know, this is why there was some talk too from Democrats. Are we going to have witnesses? Would law enforcement officers who have been injured be willing to testify? And, you know, there were, you know, I think objections to witnesses on both sides, and it ended up not happening. But, you know, that sort of thing, I think, is very powerful for a lot of people.
Elliot, I was going to put this to Amanda, but I'll put it to you. But I'm assuming for the House Democrats, there were several audiences, obviously the senators there, but also the American public, that they were getting to see what it is that the senators were watching.
Absolutely. And, you know, a big part of the stagecraft of trials is, you know, pulling audiences in and making them connect with you. If you notice, there was a lot of personal narrative in how each of the House managers talked about themselves, their families, their feelings on the day. And some of that is to, you know, connect with the senators. Some of that is to recent people at home. Quick story. I remember the judge I clerked for once told me, you know, don't wear cufflinks in front of a jury, because when you're arguing a case, you know, you want people to find you approachable and believable and credible, and flashy, jangly jewelry gets away from that. And it's similarly, make them figure out ways to connect with them personally. And I do think a big part of this was making this seem like these were human beings, family people who were attacked. And in addition to the seat of government, look at what they almost did to us.
Well, and what they actually did to a number of police officers. I mean, one was killed, two have committed suicide, one had a heart attack. Their injuries, I think one is going to lose an eye or has lost an eye. We saw the video of a police person being beaten with the American flag. Let me play something. And this is what actually Representative Jamie Raskin said towards the end of his testimony, but it was about the experience of two black officers at the Capitol. And again, this was on January 6th.
For several hours straight, as the marauders punched and kicked and mauled and spit upon and hit officers with baseball bats and fire extinguishers, cursed the cops, and stormed our Capitol, he defended us and he lived every minute of his oath of office. And afterwards, overwhelmed by emotion, he broke down in the rotunda. And he cried for 15 minutes. And he shouted out, "I got called an N-word 15 times today." And then he recorded, "I sat down with one of my buddies, another black guy, and tears just started streaming down my face. And I said, 'What the F, man? Is this America?'" That's the question before all of you in this trial. Is this America?
I mean, so profound. Amanda, if I can go back to you, there's so many things to say about this. One is just the pain and suffering, frankly, that so many of these police officers went through, and the fact that this police officer defending our government had to have the N-word thrown at him multiple times. But Republicans, you know, they call themselves law and order. How can they listen to or watch the police being beaten by these white mobsters and not be moved? I don't understand.
Yes, I think a lot of people agree with you. And I think, you know, the Republican senators would say that, you know, obviously what happened is terrible, but it's not President Trump's fault. And that's what this goes back to. They are pointing to the fact that he spoke, you know, before he did tell his people to march on the Capitol at that Stop the Steal rally earlier in the day. But they are pointing to one line saying that he told them to do so peacefully. But he also told them to fight. And he also, as Elliot said, you know, this was going on for you know, weeks, if not months, of him saying that the election was being stolen from him, pointing out his enemies. I mean, you know, President Trump, I mean, we've all seen enough Trump speeches and seen enough tweets that, you know, he often speaks in not so coded language, making clear what he wants, encouraging violence, condoning violence. And, you know, we've seen in the reports of the people who have been arrested that they say they believed they were following President Trump's orders. He's the president. They were doing what he said. If he had told them to stop, he would have, but they were doing what he told them to do. And that's why they had come to D.C. and marched on the Capitol. And so you're seeing Democrats use a lot of that evidence to say, you know, how can you say that Trump is not responsible when the people who did this say they were following his orders?
Elliot, about a minute before our second break here, but from a legal point of view, what is incitement then?
Essentially whipping people up to commit a crime. But the important thing here, and this is right picking up perfectly where Amanda left off, the legal concept here is foreseeability. Could you, the president, have reasonably foreseen that his conduct would have led to the violence? And given, you know, and the most instructive example that we saw of this was the truck rally in Texas. If you remember, pardon me, the pickup trucks running the Biden bus off the road in Texas, that those were individuals who were directly whipped up by President Trump's words, who felt that it was okay to behave in a violent manner towards supporters of Joe Biden. And we stopped talking and thinking about that incident because calamity was avoided. But my God, imagine if that bus had been run off the road. We'd be still talking about that. So that's just one instance of President Trump's rhetoric actually leading to violence. It is not inconceivable, and it's certainly under the law foreseeable to believe that it could have happened here. One last point.
Well, you know what?
We'll pick it up after.
Playing my song. Oh, we have to take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about what we learned yesterday, day two of the impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. Elliot Williams and Amanda Turkle, our guests. And we got a lot of comments here. I'll be sure to read them after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about what we learned at yesterday's impeachment trial. We'll be talking about what to expect today from the Democrats and from Trump's attorneys, who will have the floor on Friday. And we are digging into some of the legal and unconstitutional issues at stake and the likely political fallout. Amanda Turkle, Huffington Post Washington Bureau Chief, and Elliot Williams, CNN legal and analyst. And Elliot, I had to interrupt you, but you were talking about incitement. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to make a slightly different point, just responding to that beautiful, powerful, riveting clip from Representative Raskin, where he has the police officer asking, is this America? Is this the America we live in? And frankly, I just have to say, as a black man in America, I can tell you it is America. And it does not take being on the wrong side of a riot to be called the N-word. And I won't say the word on air. It's a family program. But it's, you know, unfortunately, you know, I'm not going to blame Donald Trump for all of the racism in the United States of America right now, but he's certainly given a home and a voice to people to behave in a manner like they did on that day. And so, yes, this is America. We've just now seen it in a riot at the seat of democracy.
And I guess the question is, I mean, there's a decision that has to be made about whether the president, the former president, is guilty and then prevented from running for office again. And then there's the larger question, Amanda, about, you know, if this is America, what do we do about it?
Yes, I think that's,
and that's
right.
A big one. Yes.
Yeah, I think, you know, that. You know, that's what people have been, a lot of people have been sort of grappling with over the last year, the last 4 years, is that, you know, it's Trump, Trump and his supporters, you know, his most extreme supporters may not be an anomaly. You know, you hear from a lot of people, right, this is not America, this is not what America looks like. But, you know, you talk to a lot of people of color, for example, and other people who have been marginalized, and they say, no, this is exactly what America is. This has been our experience with America. And, you know, it's just finally coming to view and coming out front in a way that you can't avoid, and that, you know, that you've had the privilege, I think, to not see. And so, right, the question is now, what do you do about it? And I think President Joe Biden has been trying to lower the temperature. He's been calling for unity. It has not been what Republicans necessarily want is unity, which is doing whatever they want legislatively. But, you know, Joe Biden is trying to focus right now on things that are broadly popular and he thinks will help, you know, the majority of the people in the country. And that is moving forward on a coronavirus stimulus bill that has broad bipartisan support. It's quite large, $1.9 trillion. And he's arguing, you know, just because a bunch of Republicans don't sign on to it doesn't mean it doesn't bring the country together, because polling shows that most people support it, even if, you know, the partisan Republicans don't.
A lot of moving parts. Let me read some comments. One from Philip: Republican senators probably thought yesterday's defense was irrelevant because the defense already argued that Trump had nothing to do with the rioters rioting. An email question from Patricia: I'm wondering what your guests think about the core reasons why so many Republican senators remain so stoic, impenetrable in regard to the evidence against Trump. Is it purely interest in preserving their jobs? Is there something else? I'm just going to leave that question out there. One from Judy. Here's a comment: some Republican senators may be poised to argue that it is inappropriate or unconstitutional to impeach a president who's no longer in office, although they took care of that on Tuesday. However, Mitch McConnell had requested to delay the hearing to give Trump's new team of lawyers time to prepare. This was a nonpartisan agreement. Again, I'll just leave that out there. Elliot, what do you expect today? And you said earlier, but I've heard other people argue that we do need to hear from witnesses who were at the White House the afternoon of January 6th to tell us what Trump was doing or not doing. We've heard, you know, secondhand, sometimes even third-hand reports that he was pleased with what he saw on TV and was reluctant to intervene or to stop his supporters. But wouldn't it be helpful to hear from someone who was there?
Yeah. When I say, and this is an important little legal point, you know, when I say we don't need the witnesses, there's this concept of relevance in the law, and not in the common colloquial sense, but relevance is any fact that serves to prove a point in evidence more or less likely to happen, right? This is relevant evidence, but it's not required evidence. And so what I mean is you can convict Donald Trump of inciting a riot based on all of the evidence that's already in the record and already publicly available. You can, it's there. You know, going back to the, you know, even using the example of the Texas trucks and the bus and the tweets and everything, that's right there sufficient. Now, would it be colorful and humanizing and interesting and compelling to hear from people in the White House or the mayor of the District of Columbia talking about her request for the National Guard being denied or any of these things? Of course it would be wonderful to hear, but just as a, you know, what would be needed to establish the legal point here? You just don't need it.
Hmm. Here's a question from Thomas. Amanda, I'll put it to you. I understand the case for barring someone from unelected office, but what is the justification for barring someone from future elected office? It seems unjustifiably paternalistic to voters. And, you know, if assuming, I don't think it's going to happen, but assuming he is convicted, he would be barred from running again. And our listener wants to know, you know, why not let the voters decide? Can you speak to that?
Sure. I mean, I guess I can see where, you know, I can see where the listener is coming from. But I think, you know, the other argument is if you do something that's considered so awful that you can get, you know, 67 senators to vote that it's so terrible that you should be thrown out of office or never barred or barred from running ever again, that you just can't be trusted with, you know, this job of protecting the Constitution, that, you know, you have made it so that, you know, you basically, again, he just can't be trusted. And I'm not sure I have a problem with that necessarily. And I think probably most people wouldn't. But, you know, I definitely see where the listener is coming from.
Sure.
And to be clear, you know, the issue is not Senate Democrats today. It's James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay.
Right.
Right. I mean, this is not some vindictive, petty thing that Democrats made up. This is how our government was set up 230 years ago or so. Anyway, that's it.
Elliot, here's one of our listeners says, this is an egregious action on both sides. I'm thinking about when protesters occupied the Madison, Wisconsin Capitol, and Nancy Pelosi congratulated them. And that was a year or so ago, and it had to do with, unions and teachers and all of that. And I've heard that argument before. What's the response to that?
There's simply no response. Number one, if people engaged in vandalism or violent conduct and were sent there by an elected official, all of those people can and should be held accountable. Number two, the ability of people and the desire of people to try to both sides the conduct of Donald Trump is simply absurd. I saw Senator Roy Blunt yesterday now teasing or telegraphing that the next phase of this is going to be about Black Lives Matter. That, oh, well, look, last summer, a bunch of protesters in Portland and Seattle engaged in acts of violence. So come on, what's a little bit of insurrection among friends? Like, it is just so easy for folks to try to deny the reality of this conduct by pointing to other places where people violated the law. And that's just simply... It is inappropriate to give someone a free pass for that.
I'd like to jump in because I believe the protests they're probably talking about were the ones in 2011 protesting Scott Walker's anti-union measures. And I was out in Wisconsin covering that. And I didn't sleep in the Capitol, but I was sleeping at a hotel sort of right on the square. And I was there every day.
Oh, wow.
And, it was nothing like what happened at the Capitol. On January 6th, there was no violence. They didn't barge in. They didn't break windows. They didn't break down doors. You know, they were there. They were occupying. They were demonstrating peacefully. They were speaking to lawmakers. You know, they were working with law enforcement and following the rules. You know, there were counter protesters outside, the Tea Party members, who honestly were also peaceful. And, you know, the discussions I had with both sides were cordial. You know, this was completely different. These were not protesters. This was a mob of rioters who came armed and intent on doing violence, as we've seen from the arrest reports, that they were willing and ready to kill members of Congress if they saw them.
Thank you for that corrective, because I do think, you know, details get lost in the mist of history. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499, talking about the impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. Let me play one more clip, and this is from the impeachment trial of yesterday. Representative Stacey Plaskett of the Virgin Islands comparing the Capitol riot of January 6th to the attack of September 11th. Let's give it a listen.
When I first saw this model that was created for this, I thought back to September 11th. I know a lot of you senators were here. Some of you might have been members on the House side. I was also here on September 11th. I was a staffer at that time. My office was on the west front of the Capitol. I worked in the Capitol, and I was on the House side. This year is 20 years since the attacks of September 11th. And almost every day, I remember that 44 Americans gave their lives to stop the plane that was headed to this Capitol building. I thank them every day for saving my life and the life of so many others.
Elliot, I picked that because I felt like she was saying, in both subtle and unsubtle ways, have courage. Mm. You know, have courage of your convictions, of your vote, because look at what these passengers did, essentially to save this Capitol building. The plane, sadly, you know, crashed in western Pennsylvania. But what did you make of what she was trying to say there?
It was a perfect point because, you know, that it felt her narrating, even before she said that, felt like the 9/11 Commission report, with the play-by-play of the tragedy and the facts and the timestamps of when things happened. And we haven't seen something like that in those years. And the amazing parallel is that for all of us who lived through these things, the day before January 5th or September 10th was vastly different than January 7th or September 12th. For all of us, life was changed irreparably. And case in point, like, I remember I was in New York City on 9/11 and remember the fighter jets. The city had, New York City, the city literally that never sleeps, had slept. It was totally quiet with no cars on the road. And there were fighter jets circling overhead, which were the only things, fighter jets and ambulances. And I, at that moment, said, I'm like, you know, this, we're never going to be normal. Again, here, I live about a mile from the Capitol building, and the whole section of town is now fenced off with razor wire. So it was a very powerful point for her to make. And also, calling back to the moments right after 9/11, there was broad bipartisan unity before the debate started on the Iraq war, which, Afghanistan. Before that, everybody was united that the United States needed to work together to respond in some way, but then everything broke apart. And I think that perhaps she was trying, rightfully so, to tap into that.
Yeah. A couple of comments here. One from Lisa: message to Republican senators, Trump would throw any of you under the bus if it served him to do so. Stop kowtowing to this huge bully. A comment from Michael: Senate Republicans, did they swear an oath to the Constitution or to their party? Their actions indicate it was the latter. Amanda, let me go to you. I'm actually looking at a headline of a brand new Huffington Post story. I'm just going to read the headline. At least 9 far-right insurrectionists have a history of violence against women. Can you expand on that for us?
Sure. So, you know, this is not, this was a great piece by my coworker, Alana Vagianos. And, you know, I think it was a smart piece because it's not, I think, surprising to people who follow sort of cases of domestic abuse that we see a lot of people who do have these records also have a tendency for this extreme violence. We see this a lot of times in sort of mass shootings. We see this in other sort of crimes out there that, you know, you wouldn't think are directly related to domestic violence. But it ends up that a lot of these men do have these records. And, you know, this is one of the things where I think, you know, it's sort of domestic violence, again, is one of those undercovered issues, but it can be something that shows that these are warning signs that authorities need to take seriously because they can, you know, sort of balloon into these other crimes.
We are almost out of time here, Elliot. What do you think the Trump lawyers need to do? They'll be on the stage starting tomorrow.
Well, they need to do a better job than they did in their opening argument. It was not crisp or sound or even legally correct. But again, as we've been talking about, they don't really need to do that much because 45 members of the audience, 44 at this point, have at least signaled some level of concern or disagreement with the whole point of the proceeding. So I think they just have to not let the president talk and make the case they want. They're incorrect as a matter of law. They're on the wrong side of history, but I think they're going to win.
And you think they're going to win? Amanda, any final thoughts from you?
You know, I think it still looks very, very unlikely that Trump is convicted, but I think it's been important for Democrats to sort of get this all in front of the public and as a reminder of sort of what happened and what Trump's role was.
Well, we're going to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Amanda Turkle, nice to have you back with us on the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she's Washington Bureau Chief for Huffington Post. And Elliot Williams, nice to have you on the show for the first time. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He's a CNN legal analyst and previously served as counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee. And that was 07-09 under then, Judiciary Committee Chairman Senator Chuck Schumer. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.